It is my honor and privilege to introduce our guest for today. He is not new to Concordia Seminary. Upon receiving a Churchill scholarship in 1971, he came to spend 3 months here, browsing our library in the Concordia Historical Institute, gathering materials, photocopying the way he makes it sound, half of the materials in those two institutions to take back to England with him, where over the next period of years he pored over the material to begin his real work in some respect. He has been back in the Luther year of 1983, the Bach year of 1985, and Dr. Fremder brought him here for the music workshop of 2 summers ago, of the summer of 86. He came to know a little bit more about the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod through the auspices or finding out about Concordia Publishing House. He was impressed by its publications, especially in the area of church music. He subscribed to CTM at that time and came to know more and more about it. And later on, in a sense, CPH returned the favor. I can think of at least 5 books that they have published of his. A book on Bach's Passions, on Heinrich Schütz. He was editor of this work by Günter Stiller on Johann Sebastian Bach. Robin, you have done us a great favor by bringing us perhaps a little arm twisting of Concordia Publishing House, but that they brought this to us. This magnificent volume, actually, which is based upon the Bach Kalev Bible in the library here, and Robin did this one in gathering the material, making a commentary on that Bible, and another slender little volume, Luther on Justification. We must not overlook that. When we received in England the library of an eminent theologian of the Independent Church in Germany, Wilhelm Esch, in the library, that little volume was found with many markings in it. And if any of you know about the character and nature of Dr. Esch, he is a very demanding theologian. He was known to be very strict in his orthodoxy. When I read in there that he had recommended to his daughter that this book be given to her husband, who was not Lutheran, because it would be very good for him, then I knew that Robin Lever had truly arrived in the ranks of Lutheran Orthodoxy. He's president of the Internationale Arbeitsgemeinschaft für Hymnologie, which is impressive enough, one way or another. He has published in such journals as the Bach Jahrbuch, in the journal Bach, in Musik und Kirche, in Organ Yearbook, in Early Music, in the Expository Times, and his current ventures for Oxford University Press, his dissertation from Groningen in the Netherlands on the development of English and Dutch metrical psalmody, and his thesis was to show the Lutheran background to those. For GIA in this country, 3 volumes on hymnology. He's also editing for them an anthology of liturgies with music. For Pueblo, the Roman Catholic publishers, a survey, a history of hymnody. And we are very pleased to hear that he has made real progress on a collection of all the hymn texts and the tunes that went with them of Martin Franzmann's hymns, to be published, we hope, in the near future. And Dr. Lever's significant introduction to that will, I think, be a real joy and delight. He is presently Associate Professor of Church Music and Director of Chapel at Westminster Choir College, Princeton, New Jersey. I am very pleased to present Dr. Robin Lever.
It's difficult to actually stand up and say something after hearing what sounds like your obituary. And when I hear all the projects I'm trying to do, maybe the next time you will hear about me, it will be my obituary. I wanted to speak about, by the way, how long have I got? When do I actually have to stop? That's
clear off at half past 11.
Okay, I'll have to talk quickly then. And, okay, I will try to reduce some of this material so that there will be some time for questions. Let me plunge straight in with the Vesper service in the Lutheran tradition. But then to speak about the Vesper service as if there were one basic liturgical order followed in Orthodox Lutheran churches in northern Germany is perhaps a little misleading, because there were many different types of Vesper services held daily, Monday to Friday throughout the week, on Saturdays, on the eves of major festivals, of saints' days, as well as on Sundays. And there could be as many as three different Vesper services, variously called Betstunde, Hour of Prayer, Catechismus Examen, Catechism Examination, Vesper Predigt, Vesper Sermon, or Vesper Gottesdienst, Vesper Worship. And each one offered a different context for liturgy, preaching, hymnody, music. But we need to look at the roots of this particular tradition, the Lutheran tradition of Vespers. It has its roots, of course, in the canonical hours or the daily offices of pre-Reformation monasticism. Throughout each 24 hours, at three hourly intervals, there were the eight offices of Matins, Lourdes, Prime, Terce, Sext, Nones, Nones, Vespers, and Compline. These were essentially prayer services, primarily based on the chanting of the psalms together with their antiphons and with their responsories. Indeed, in the course of every week, the whole Psalter, all 150 psalms, were sung in these three hourly services. Each service also had its own office hymn, which might either be an invariable text, such as Te Lucis Ante Terminum at Compline, or a De Tempora hymn, which reflected the season or the festival of the church year. And of the eight canonical hours, Matins and Vespers, the principal morning and evening services, assumed a priority and importance over the other six. For example, it was incumbent upon secular parish clergy in pre-Reformation days not only to say Mass each day, but also to say Matins and Vespers. Now, when Luther and his colleagues came to reform the patterns of worship, the worship of the churches in Wittenberg and elsewhere, they were critical of the unreformed attitude which regarded these services merely as private priestly duty, a duty, moreover, that went largely unfulfilled. For example, in the preface to the Saxon Kirchenordnung, first issued in 1539 and signed by such colleagues of Luther as Jonas, Spalatin, and Krusiger, the following is related. It reads, "See how the papists laugh at their own canonical hours. One of them said to another, 'I do not have much money or corn, but I do have certain debts and several barns full of unprayed Vespers and Matins.'" Liturgical reform in Wittenberg began with the abandonment of the daily Mass, for which Luther substituted revised forms of Matins and Vespers. However, these services were not considered as priestly duty, but rather as communal acts of worship and devotion. They were public services of worship for lay people as well as for clergy, as the title of Luther's small pamphlet in which the matter is dealt with makes very clear, the order of worship in the congregation of 1523. Now, these weekday services, each of which lasted 1 hour, were introduced in Wittenberg on the 23rd of March, 1523. Matins began at 4 or 5 a.m. in the morning, depending on the time of year, winter or summer, and had the following order: an Old Testament lesson, one or two chapters, read consecutively from day to day, a sermon on the lesson, then a collect, and then psalmody. Vespers was held daily at 5 or 6, depending on the time of year, and had the same structure as Matins, except that the lesson was taken from the New Testament, so you had the Old Testament in the morning, the New Testament in the evening, so that there would be, to quote Luther, reading, interpreting, praising, singing, and praying, just as at the morning. Now, each section has very clear musical implications. concerning the lesson, Luther states that it must be read either by pupils or priests, or whoever it may be, in the same manner as the lesson is still read at unreformed matins. This should be done, he says, by one or two, or by one individual or choir, responding to one to the other, as may seem suitable. In other words, the biblical lections are to be chanted to the traditional lectionary tones, sung either by various individual voices or groups of singers. The function of the sermon was to explain the meaning of the lesson so that it could be understood as well as heard. If this is not done, says Luther, the congregation is not benefited by the lesson, as has been the case in cloisters and convents, where they only bawled, B-A-W-L-E-D, they only bawled the lesson against the walls, though in English that's a nice image, play on words. On Sunday at Mass and Vespers, he, quote, there should be preaching for the whole congregation in the morning on the gospel for the day and in the evening on the epistle. And this became the almost invariable practice of later Lutheran Sunday preaching, with the preaching in the morning on the gospel, at Vespers on the epistle for the day. The collect is connected with the chants of the day. Every morning the pastor, quote, shall appoint a fitting responsory or antiphon with a collect. Likewise for the evening, this is to be read and chanted publicly after the lesson and exposition. Luther explains the psalmody thus. He says, now when the lesson and its interpretation have lasted half an hour or so, the congregation shall unite in giving thanks to God, in praising him and in praying for the fruits of the word, etc. For this, the psalms should be used and some good responsories and antiphons. Now the implication is that there should be half an hour of psalm singing, with the psalms sung to the traditional psalm tones. And what is somewhat revolutionary here is that Luther intended at this stage, certainly, that the whole congregation should sing the traditional psalm tones, something that only priests, monks, and nuns had done hitherto. Now, there may have been some difficulty in actually getting the Wittenberg congregations to sing traditional Gregorian psalm chants, or the psalm tones. It needs to be borne in mind that this congregational form of daily worship was introduced in the early spring of 1523. Within 6 months, Luther had created the metrical psalm, the psalm hymn, the biblical psalm rendered into strophic poetry, which is certainly much easier for a congregation to sing, especially a congregation for whom such singing was something of a novelty. But here in this order, we have the beginnings of the Lutheran tradition of congregational song, because Luther prescribes psalmody as the daily diet at this revised form of matins and vespers. Here is the origin of the Lutheran tradition of congregational song, the chorale from which develops this rich heritage which you have of choral, organ, and instrumental music, which is based upon congregational song. Now, with these liturgical reforms, Luther established the basic elements of the later Lutheran Vespers tradition. First, it was essentially a musical order of worship in which traditional plain chant was to continue. Luther states categorically, let the chants in the Sunday Masses and Vespers be retained. They are quite good, and they're taken from Scripture. Second, the congregation was expected to articulate its prayer and praise in corporate song. Third, with this openness to both traditional chant on the one hand and to newly introduced congregational singing on the other, a liturgical environment was created in which organ and choral music could freely develop with the congregational music. Fourth, in contrast to monastic vespers, in which the biblical lections were generally confined to just a few verses, substantial portions of Scripture were not only to be read, but they were also to be expounded and explained in sermons. Indeed, as far as Luther was concerned, if there was no preaching, there would be no Vespers. Now, this 1523 pamphlet was written in German, and since it also calls for congregational psalmody, the implication is that these daily services would have been in the vernacular. However, the possibility of employing Latin was not excluded, as is made clear in the Formula Missae of Luther of 1523, later on, that is, that same year. In his words on Matins and Vespers, Luther largely repeats what he'd said in the earlier German pamphlet. But there is some new material. For example, he has a particular suggestion regarding the number of psalms sung at these services. He says the bishop may reduce the great length of these services according to his own judgment, so that three psalms may be sung for Matins and three for Vespers, with one or two responsories. Now, this represents a significant reduction in the daily psalmody. Previously, Matins had nine psalms and eight responsories, and Vespers and Compline had eight psalms and one responsory. At first, Luther wanted his congregations to sing the traditional psalm turns, but this was obviously proving to be somewhat difficult, and he was already thinking towards metrical psalmody and strophic hymnody. However, the practice of chanting the psalms was not to be lost to emerging Lutheranism, because Luther saw that psalmody had educational as well as spiritual benefits. And therefore, the pupils of the parish schools would take part in the daily Matins and Vespers. The parish schools, in which Latin was the educational language, Luther states, quote, "It is seemly, nay, necessary, that the boys should get accustomed to reading and hearing the Psalms and lessons from Holy Scripture." End quote. And the role of the school choir, or cantori, in the liturgy was given particular attention in subsequent months and years in Wittenberg and elsewhere in Germany. In the Formula Missae, Luther also speaks of retaining the response Deo Gratias at the end of these services, and does so in the general context of congregational hymnody. Earlier in the Formula Missae, he had expressed the desire for as many vernacular hymns as possible for the people to sing in the Reformed Mass. But as they had yet to be written at that surge, he suggested that in the meantime, a number of older Leisen, the folk hymns, such as Gott sei gelobet und gebenedeit and Nun bitten wir den Heiligen Geist, should be sung with profit. But he says the real need is for German poets to compose evangelical hymns for us. Interestingly, in Speratus's German translation of the Formula Missae, made under Luther's supervision in Wittenberg and issued the following year in 1524, that phrase is expanded to read, "German poets and musicians are needed to compose evangelical hymns for us." Significant development. Now, over the next few months, that is approximately from mid-1523 to mid-1524, Luther and his colleagues were feverishly at work writing vernacular metrical psalms and strophic hymns for congregational use. However, Luther's first hymnal was not a congregational collection. Instead, it was a set of part books for the choir to use, including polyphonic settings of 38 of the hymns that were then being introduced, together with a few Latin motets, all of them composed by Johann Volta, Volta composing under Luther's supervision, the Geistliche Gesangbuchlein of Wittenberg 1524, the so-called Chorgesangbuch, choral hymn book. And Luther's policy at this stage seems to have been that the hymns would initially be taught in the schools, first from the tenor part book, which contained most of the melodies, and then the complete cantus firmus polyphonic settings in 3 to 5 voices. And when they had been mastered in the school, they were then transplanted into the church within the liturgy as the gradual lead, the hymn of the day, in the Reformed Mass, and also to be sung in Sunday Vespers. And these polyphonic settings were sung by the choir in alternation with the congregation, which sang the alternate stanzas in unison, supported by the choir. So we had one stanza from the congregation in unison, unaccompanied, next stanza sung by the choir in a polyphonic setting, where the part writing surrounds the basic familiar melody, or which was becoming familiar melody. And at this stage, the congregation was using broadsheet mimeographed copies, if you like, of the hymns. But within a matter of months, a congregational hymn book is introduced. And it contained all the hymns in Walter's Chorgesangbuch. It was a congregational edition of the part books, and there are given the associated melodies. So you can see that the reform in liturgy, of daily liturgy as well as weekly liturgy, is heavily congregational, and that the role of the choir was to introduce the hymnody and to encourage the singing of the congregation, but it was done in a highly artistic way. Towards the end of 1525 or early 26, Luther issued the Deutsche Messe. His German liturgical provisions, which were meant to complement rather than replace the formula missa. The pupils from the schools, that is, those who would primarily form the liturgical choir, or cantorae, were to play a leading role at matins and vespers. Luther's purpose was partly didactic. He says this is what we do to train the boys and pupils in the Bible, let them sing it and therefore learn it. Earlier in the Deutsche Messe, Luther had reflected on the need for Christian education within the context of worship. He says the German service needs a plain and simple, fair and square catechism. Namely, in these three parts, the Ten Commandments, the Creed, and the Lord's Prayer. These three plainly and briefly contain exactly everything that a Christian needs to know. This instruction must be given from the pulpit and at stated times. Now, although the context of Vespers is not specifically stated here, once Luther had published his small catechism in 1529, it became customary to preach on the catechism at Vespers and especially on Sundays. In the Deutsche Messe, Luther also outlines the daily services, which remain substantially the same as earlier, except that the New Testament now is read in the morning and the Old Testament in the afternoon. He says, likewise, at Vespers, the schoolboys sing a few of the Vesper Psalms in Latin with an antiphon, as heretofore, followed by a Latin hymn if one is available. Again, two or three boys in turn read a chapter from the Latin Old Testament, or half a one, depending on length. Another boy reads the same chapter in German. The Magnificat follows in Latin with an antiphon or German hymn. The Lord's Prayer is said silently, and the Collects with the Benedicamus. This is the daily service throughout the week in cities where there are schools. Now, what is significant here is that Luther incorporated much more of the monastic office than he did in his daily services issued some 3 years earlier. In particular, the Latin hymn, the Lord's Prayer, and especially the Vesper Canticle, the Magnificat, have all returned. In 1536, Wolfgang Musculus, a pastor in Augsburg, visited Wittenberg to attend a conference of Reformation theologians from many parts of Europe. Now, during his visit, he kept a diary, in which is a valuable eyewitness account of some of the liturgical practices in Wittenberg. On May the 14th, Cantate Sunday, that is, the fourth Sunday after Easter, he gives the following description of Vespers in Wittenberg. He said the Vesper service was held at 1 p.m., and throughout followed papistical customs with plain chant, except that the gospel for the Sunday was sung in the vernacular by a boy in a high place. After Vespers, a sermon was given on the second commandment, thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Thereafter was sung, Christus the Standard. Now, this witness of Musculus is very important. In some respects, he is a hostile witness, in that he himself was moving on to a Zwinglian reformed, as opposed to Lutheran, views, becoming eventually a professor of theology in Bern, in Switzerland. And it was these reformed sensitivities which made him record that, in his view, Wittenberg Vespers was virtually unchanged from the unreformed monastic use, except for the expanded Bible reading and the preaching, of course. Now, this confirms Luther's statements in the Deutsche Messe and elsewhere that he intended to retain Latin usage where possible, and especially the associated plain chant, the psalm tones for both the psalms and the Magnificat, the traditional chant for those antiphons and responsories which were retained, and also the Latin plain song hymnody. In Lutheran Vespers, therefore, the monody of the ancient church
and especially the psalm tones, all were preserved as a living tradition, which continues right into the 18th century, quite late into the 18th century. And thus there was this specific liturgical need which led later composers such as Samuel Scheidt, Dietrich Buxtehude, Bach himself, to compose, well, not Bach in this respect, but certainly Scheidt and Buxtehude, composed organ music, which is directly associated with these psalm tones, and especially the psalm tones used with the Magnificat, and therefore directly Vespers music. Musculus also gives us the information that the subject of the sermon was the second of the Ten Commandments, and the implication is that a section of Luther's Small Catechism was being taught. Now we know that after the publication of the Small Catechism, indeed before it too, but for the rest of his life, Luther returns to the Catechism. He was preoccupied with it one way or another. And in particular, as well as preaching many sermons on the various sections of the Catechism, which had now grown to, there were six sections now, though I'll fight you over whether it's five or six, he completed a significant number of Catechism hymns, the commandments, Die Sünde, Heiligen Sein, Gebot, the Ten Commandments hymn, for the Creed, Wir glauben alle in einen Gott, the Lord's Prayer, Vater uns in Himmelreich, Baptism, Christus her zum Jordan kam, Repentance, Confession, Aus tiefer Not schrei ich zu dir, and the Eucharist, Jesus Christus unser Heiland. Hymns, one on each of the parts of the Catechism. Now these hymns, together with the practice of preaching on the Catechism, became a familiar part of the Lutheran Vesper service. Not only were they sung, but they were frequently quoted in Catechism sermons. Indeed, some Catechism sermons were directly based on the hymns themselves. For example, August Pfeiffer, superintendent in Lübeck during Buxtehude's time there, he preached a series of sermons on these Catechism hymns of Luther in the year 1698. Again and again, in the 200 years or so between the 16th and 18th century, Lutheran composers wrote chorale preludes on the melodies of these catechism hymns, clearly for use within these Vesper services, and the most notable collection being the large and small catechism preludes of Johann Sebastian Bach, his Klavierübung Part 3. But let's return to the witness of Musculus in 1536. The Augsburg pastor states that following the Vesper sermon on May the 14th, Christus der Standen was sung at the Haupt. This is in Vespers. He reports that at the Hauptgottesdienst in the morning of the same day, that in between the Epistle and Gospel there had been an organ prelude, which led into the choir singing the Easter sequence Victime Paschale Laudes, in alternation with a congregation singing the stanzas of the vernacular hymn Christ ist der Stander. So you had a Latin stanza, if you can call it a stanza, sung Victime Paschale. Congregation responds by singing Christ ist der Stander. Then you have a second stanza from the Latin. Then you have another from the congregation. And it's possible that something similar occurred at Vespers, although Musculus seems to suggest that only the German hymn was sung, Christus der Standard. But whatever the exact performance practice on that day, whatever it was, it is likely that the unaccompanied singing of the congregation was preceded by a suitable organ prelude, as happened in the morning liturgy. You see, what we find happening in Wittenberg is that the liturgy is a very rich affair. You have monody unaccompanied, the plain chant, you have hymnody, which is unaccompanied, but the organ precedes it, giving you the shape of the melody, giving you the pitch, and then off you go. You then have the alternation with the choir singing these polyphonic versions of the hymn tune. It was very, very rich musical experience within the liturgy. And one of the gradual lead in the Hauptgottesdienst was featured in this way, and the hymn of the day, similarly at Vespers. One of the hymns was always treated in this extensive way, sometimes mixing Latin and German. Now, as the Reformation spread throughout Germany, a series of church orders containing outline liturgical forms, usually based on Wittenberg practice, began to appear. In North Germany, most of the important church orders were drawn up by Johannes Bugenhagen. Bugenhagen, the pastor of the Stadtkirche in Wittenberg, colleague and confessor of Luther, very much the organizer of the young Lutheran church. He was responsible for the following church orders: Brunswick, 1528, Hamburg, 1529, Lübeck, 1531, Pomerania, 1534, Denmark, 1537, Holstein, also in the north, 1542, Brunswick, Wolfenbüttel, 1543, Hildesheim, 1544. Now, all of these church orders are very similar in content, and in particular those of Hamburg and Lübeck in the north stand really quite close to each other in detail. Now, in general, it can be said that the prescriptions for Matins and Vespers in these church orders closely follow Luther's Deutsche Messe. The Lübeck Church Order of 1531, which remained in force well into the 18th century, deals with daily Vespers within a section headed "On the Singing and Reading of the Pupils in the Churches." Now, like the Deutsche Messe, it is a general description rather than a specific liturgy. However, Bugenhagen gives much more detail than Luther in the Deutsche Messe. He also reduces the service from 1 hour to half an hour in duration, and the service is almost entirely in Latin. Only the lesson, read after its equivalent in Latin, and some of the hymnody being in German. What we have is an antiphon sung by two boys, and then psalms between 1 to 3, depending on their length, sung antiphonally, verse by verse, by the pupils, divided into two choirs, and then the antiphon is repeated. Sometimes there would be a responsory sung with a Gloria Patri on eves of feasts, on feast days, only on those days. Then there would be, on the eves of feasts and feast days, a hymn, a Latin hymn. Then comes the lesson from the Old Testament, chanted by three boys in Latin, and then clearly and carefully read in German, without chant, it says, by a fourth boy. Then Luther's Latin litany, sung antiphonally at Saturday Vespers as a penitential preparation for the worship of the next day, because we know that confession took place on the Saturdays in preparation for the Eucharist on the Sundays. Then the office hymn. The hymns of Ambrose and Prudentius are specifically noted. Then an antiphon, the Magnificat, and with an antiphon repeated, sung by the two choirs of boys. Kyrie, sung, Kyrie Christe, Kyrie, threefold, Lord's Prayer, then the sermon. this is in Lübeck, it comes rather late in elsewhere, and in Wittenberg, the sermon followed followed on the reading and came before the Magnificat. Then you had versicles, and then the Benedicamus sung at the end. Now, on major festivals, following the Benedicamus, which normally marked the end of Vespers, the Nunc Dimittis with the Gloria Patri was sung by the choirs in Lübeck, and appropriate hymns of the season followed. Now, that practice of continuing after Vespers on feast days was later expanded into an opportunity for much more elaborate music, and ultimately leads to the Abendmusik of Dietrich Buxtehude in Lübeck. Now, this process of the musical elaboration of Vespers was begun under Luther's guidance. His colleague Johann Walter, cantor in Torgau, produced at least two manuscript collections of polyphonic Vesper music. And over the years, we find that there are publications from Georg Rau in Wittenberg for choir music. We have collections of the monody for use by the celebrant, all being published for these for the use at Vespers. And what is very clear is that Vespers began to grow as a, especially on feast days, as a very special occasion. On weekdays, it was a very simple prayer service, as it had been in origin in monastic days. But as time went on, it becomes a very important musical occasion. For example, what you have developing is the expansion of the gospel motet. What happened fairly early on was that the gospel or the epistle motet also, what happened was the composers wrote took the key verse from the epistle or the gospel for the gospel and the epistle for the day at the Vespers, it would have been the epistle, and they set it musically. And it was a counterpart of the sermon. It was a focusing in on the main teaching of the day. What happens over the course of time is that this this short motet becomes enlarged as the centuries roll on. You have the introduction of instruments for accompaniment, and you have the growth of the very distinctive Lutheran tradition of church music. You have the Vespers music, which you get a lot of organ music, and you get the Psalm and Davids of Schütz were performed at Vespers. You have the musikalische Andachten, musical devotions of Hammerschmidt. You have the cantatas of Buxtehude. You have the cantatas of Bach. It's a rich tradition, and the whole purpose of this music is to undergird and support the principal teaching or the celebration of the festival. That these cantatas, these musical pieces were not thought to be entertainment stuck in because there was nothing else to do or because you needed some pause or some break in the flow of the liturgy. They were part of the liturgy. The word was read, and the word was proclaimed with word only through the pulpit. The word was proclaimed in music and word through the cantata that developed. And it's a very strong tradition. And there is a fantastic collection of music by Hassler, Frank, Pretoria, Schein, and many, many, many more. And there are historical examples, and I haven't time to give you some of the details, but when the Reformation was celebrated in 1617 in Dresden, we have the order of service for the Vesper celebration, and it was a rather splendid one. And what they did was that they introduced into the very simple structure of the service these extra large-scale pieces. At Christmas in Lübeck with Buxtehude, again, we can give examples. We can see exactly what went on, a very rich celebration on the festivals. Now, what had begun as a private monastic discipline in medieval days became in Lutheran tradition a public devotional preaching service which took over much of the monody and the hymnody of the earlier church. But it added to it its own distinctive music and its own hymnody. And by the time of Buxtehude and Bach, the Lutheran Vespers tradition had blossomed into a rich musical, liturgical, and spiritual experience with a wide range of congregational, choral, vocal, organ, and instrumental music. Maybe that didn't happen every week. Maybe the full richness of it only happened maybe once, twice, or three times in a year. But that it happened at all was that Vespers was a continuous part of church life, the simple Vespers, day after day, week after week, that was constantly prayed with its simple chant and its simple hymnody. Then on the special occasion, out came all this marvelous celebratory music. And the question I posed for this session is, whatever happened to Lutheran Vespers? You have Lutheran Vespers in Lutheran worship. How many churches actually use it? How many churches really use it as a continuing thing? It's a great pleasure to know that 2 years ago when I came here, it was not being used in the seminary regularly, and now I hear that since that conference that we had together and talked about many of these things, it is now a common practice to use the Vesper service from Lutheran worship. And where are the Lutherans out picking up the music of their heritage, and you're not using it for the special occasion? the music of Hammerschmidt, the music of Bach. Maybe you say it's too difficult. It isn't too difficult. Maybe Bach is. Hammerschmidt isn't. Why do we not have these special occasions of Vesper services where the music is not a tack-on, an add-on, something done for special sake, you know, and the music makes the interest, but is integral to the liturgy itself, to the teaching of the day? Now, what is happening sociologically in this country and elsewhere in Western civilization, if I can put it like that? We are discovering our roots. 20 years ago, nobody was interested in the history of liturgy. Or relatively few people, certainly at a congregational level, were interested in anything historical. They wanted to do it, the worship, Sunday by Sunday. What is now happening is the whole business about preferring cotton to man-made fibers, the whole business about sorting out natural foods. Are you with me? In the music world, I wonder whether we in the churches have really caught up with what is happening in the music world. Have a look at a record catalogue and see what percentage of, quote, early music stuff there is around now. Original instrument performances, smaller chamber groups of music. And where does this music come from? A lot of it is from the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. And what is this music? Much of it that is being performed. It is Lutheran Vespers music. Where is it being performed? Concert halls, recital rooms, not in the church. Why? It is your heritage, and you can reach a lot of people if you seek to recover this heritage and use it not as a museum piece. Don't get that impression. Not as a museum piece. This music is there to be used within the liturgy, but don't use it as a museum piece. Use it as a creative way to approach liturgy and encourage composers to use the to be inspired by this music and create more music. You see, what happened with Luther was he took the tradition and molded it and changed it by adding new things on. We need to be doing the same now, finding out first of all what that tradition is and then using it and encouraging composers. Some of you know about the composer Ugo Distler in Germany. He knew that he wanted to react against the romanticism of the previous period. He wanted to create new music. How did he do that? He wrote tremendous stuff for liturgical worship, sadly neglected in Lutheran churches. But he wrote it. What was his inspiration? His inspiration was the music of Heinrich Schütz that he discovered and modeled his music on the kind of sounds but made it in a very contemporary sense. The old always creates the new. If we understand the tradition from which we come, we can use that tradition, build on it, and create new patterns of worship, which are not reactions to, but are developments from the tradition that you have. You Lutherans have, and I can speak in these terms, though I feel I am almost one of you, you Lutherans have an extraordinary, rich, musical, liturgical tradition which you are largely ignoring. And what is happening is that the people who are involved in this early music thing know nothing about the liturgy, know nothing about the theology that lies behind this music. You have a marvelous opportunity to reach such people. And it is basically amateurs who are doing this. Whatever happened to Lutheran Vespers? It's an opportunity that we need to be developing, I think, because there are two doctrines that Luther felt very strongly about. One is the doctrine of the royal priesthood of all believers. Yeah, we must be able to give the gathered congregation the opportunity to demonstrate that common priesthood. And what's the best way to do that? Luther says by music, because music is the one way that we can be unanimous. Did you listen to yourself say the creed this morning? We were not unanimous. We were all out of sync. If we had sung it, we would have been more unanimous than we were. That's Luther's point. It gathers us together. The other doctrine that Luther was very strong on was the doctrine of the communion of saints. That we're not the first Christians to have walked this planet. that we, as I was saying last night, we are the Christians who stand in that succession of faith that begins in Hebrews 11, by faith, by faith, by faith, and it hasn't stopped. And when we worship, we need the witness of our spiritual ancestors who have got something to tell us by the tradition that they recreated in their own day, and they will inspire us to use their music, their liturgical forms, and also inspire us, I believe, to create new forms that grow out of the tradition. But we cannot do that unless we know the tradition from whence we come.
We have a few minutes. If there are questions, please approach one of the microphones and address them, and you'll field them yourself.
I'll try. What happened was that the vernacular was stressed, and the chant was almost jettisoned. And what is very interesting is that in Catholic circles now, there is a realization that they now have a rootless liturgy. That in stressing the congregational nature, they have lost something of their tradition. And it's very interesting to see that there is a great concern to recover the basis of their liturgy. But it's not a question of either or. Where there are different ethnic communities, then certainly there is a need to build on, this is what I mean, to be creative and take the concept of a liturgical form and express it in another way. I don't know if you know, Gerard Cartford is working in, sponsored by the, I don't say it in this, well, Lutheran World Federation, but I've said it, working in Argentina at the moment on this very issue. Now, he is someone who comes, has a great awareness of the Lutheran tradition. And don't call it only German, because it is much wider than German. The Episcopalians share the same basic tradition of chant, as well as the Lutheran tradition. It is much wider. Indeed, I would argue that even the Reformed, though they've forgotten about it, have something of that tradition, because many of the Genevan psalm tunes were in fact based grew out of Gregorian chant. Maybe they don't know that. It's a concern to actually, liturgy can be expressed in a variety of ways, and we don't have to have the German chant, but you can have a chant form developed that grows out of the ethnic community. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that? But what I feel is unfortunate if we say that everything that has come from our European heritage has to be thrown away, and only the ethnic that particular ethnic cultural expression. We live in a multicultural situation, and it is part of our heritage, and we should not be shy of our heritage. I want to share my heritage with my brothers and sisters in Christ who have a different cultural heritage, and there is no reason why we cannot do that.
A lot more there.
Yeah. Dr. Liebert, you had mentioned before that Luther favored the teaching of psalms, psalmody, to the boys, to the children. Could you relate that to the present-day tendency of many people to feel that children need game songs in connection with religion?
Thank you very much indeed. This is a hobby horse of mine, and I will speak very strongly about it. he didn't know that. Actually, I was talking about this earlier this morning to Mrs. Foyhan. We live in a goal-setting society, and that in spiritual terms is debilitating. If you set goals, you've already predetermined where you're going, and therefore that may be limiting. Luther said, we too often pray for silver. God will give us gold, but we set our sights too low. and we set our sights too low with regard to children. We are patronizing to children. We think that they have no intelligence or very little intelligence. Yes, when you get older, you'll do it. Children have an innate rhythmic ability that puts us older ones to shame. They have an ability to sing music that you and I cannot sing. Well, not immediately, anyway. They can pick it up. Their ears are far more ready to accept things. And children have a far greater ability in music than we generally give credit for. I am appalled and by what I see of children's choirs, and I have to say this is largely Presbyterian churches that I visit, because that's very strong in their tradition, the children's choirs. I am appalled at the low standards and the acceptance that what you do when you get children together, you play a few games and then you sing a few songs, and that's good enough. All I can say is that I started singing at the age of 6 and a half, and I was plunged in, well, I won't tell you the first composer's name, but I was plunged in very soon after into Bach and Buxtehude and Scheidt. And I see around me churches that are introducing their children to teaching them how to read the dots, doing it in an encouraging way. And they are producing sounds that are really quite fantastic. And the musical maturity of these children is astonishing. Now, if we set our sights and say they can only do these little singing games, we do them an injustice. They are able to sing remarkably well. Let me give you an example. I normally wouldn't have done this, but I was invited to go to Brigham Young University last November. The terms of my going there was to help them with a reconstruction of a Lutheran liturgy, a Vespers liturgy, of around 1620 at the time of Samuel Scheidt. We used organ music, we wanted to use choral music, we had a setting of Magnificat by Hammerschmidt. And what we did for that occasion, and I would only accept to go if we did the reconstructed service, and what I did is I slipped in a sermon of Luther's. If you're going to be authentic, I argued, then you ought to hear what Luther had to say. So I slipped in a sermon on the Epistle for the Day from Luther, from the Kirchenpostille. So the Mormons got Luther. But let me tell you what they did, and it puts us to shame. That choral music was sung by a group of 10 boys who 2 months previously had never sung anything. Apart from singing along with the pop tunes on the radio. And it was astonishing what they were able to do. And I talked with them afterwards. These kids who, you know, baseball, football, they do the lot, like any kids do. I just talked to them about their experience of singing this music, and it was astonishing. They were absolutely keen on it, and they wanted that. They only did it for that occasion, but they want that group to continue because they're fascinated by this music. They were fascinated by the fun of actually doing grown-up things, if you like. That's patronizing to say that even that. But we set our sights far too low. Children can sing astonishingly well. What we need to do is to be able to understand that their capabilities are far higher, and we need to understand how to get across to children. That's not everyone can do it, but it's easier than you think. Sorry, that was too long. But
John, I have to ask you to forego. Before I thank Dr. Lever, we have a very special guest who has just arrived, and I'd like for Dr. Barth to please introduce him for us. Please.
Thank you very much, Professor Feuerhahn, for the intrusion. We are indeed honored to have with us today a special visitor from China. As you know, we have just returned and had the privilege while in Beijing to meet with Bishop Ding, the elected president of the China Christian Council. He is here in St. Louis in connection with the meeting of the United Methodist Church, which convention he addressed yesterday. He must be downtown in half an hour for a press conference, but he has been very gracious in expressing a willingness to extend a few words of greeting. So it is a great, distinct pleasure to introduce this very warm, gracious Christian leader, Bishop Ding.
I am awfully delighted to be able to be present at this meeting and to see the teachers and students of this seminary and to bring to you the greetings of the Christians in China. The most important thing that I have to say is that the church is there in China. It's a small church. The total membership of the church is probably only around 8 million in a country where the population is 1,000 million. In other words, we are less than 1% of the population. But it is a witnessing church and a growing church. We in China are very aware that we are an object of interest and concern and prayers on the part of Christians in many other countries in the world. And we feel supported by these prayers. We hope that the tie between the churches in China and churches in the United States will be strengthened. Thank you very much.
The one thing I just wanted to say is that the question of the cultural question is a very important one, that we live in a cross-cultural time, and that I did address another august body on the issue, on the theological issues of what it means to be aware of one's own culture without giving that up, and yet being able to accept another culture and other cultural expressions. And that will appear in the journal Worship in a month or two's time.
Dr. Lever, we want to thank you very much for enlightening us about something of our own heritage, and your appreciation of it, I hope, will encourage us as well. Thank you very much.